Welcome everyone to another session of our Intel Hub webinar series. Today we have Professor Matthew Crofton speaking on disinformation wars, what Russian active measures reveal about American passive society. Dr. Crofton is a member of the doctoral faculty in the School of Security and Global Studies at American Military University and has helped launch the institution's inaugural doctoral program in the school. He has published in top-tier research journals and has impacted real-world decision-making in the United States and beyond. He's published over 100 articles, analytical editorials, and commissioned opinion pieces that represent the full spectrum of global security, which have been translated into Russian, Arabic, Chinese, Indonesian, Hebrew, Spanish, Turkish, Farsi, Greek, and Uzbek. He's currently a senior research fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv, Israel. Matt has also won global fellowships at the Research Institute for European and American Studies in Athens, Greece, the China-Eurasia Council for Political and Strategic Research in Nanjing, China, and was the first American invited to conduct political analysis for the Russian International Affairs Council in Moscow, Russia. If you haven't already, I highly recommend you check out his professional page on academia.edu, as he has one of the highest ranking, holds the top global ranking for the last 40 consecutive months in over two dozen subfields and has done a great deal to advance the field. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Dr. Crofton, and we'll take it from there.
Thank you, Dr. Drumheller. As much as I love the introduction, it always makes me feel awkward. Today's, what I want to start off with first is just to welcome and thank you all the people who are here. Hopefully we'll keep this interesting. We've agreed with Dr. Drumheller that if someone has a question in the middle of the presentation that pertains specifically to something I'm talking about, please feel free to type it up in the chat box and we can postpone what I'm saying and deal with it immediately. But I do intend to leave ample time at the end for people to ask questions, so you won't be sort of squeezed at the end of 5 minutes. Ultimately, what we're looking at today is sort of three topics in one. The disinformation data I'll touch upon fairly briefly. There's a mountain of it, but I'd like to give a background exposure to everyone in the room as far as what the disinformation data of 2016 actually shows and what it might mean. We have to then talk about this post-truth, this so-called post-truth phenomenon in America. And then if post-truth really has an impact, does it in fact make disinformation permanent? And if it is going to be permanent, what do we do about it as a society? And to sort of combine that sort of the formal scholarly academic background of what we discussed today, there is also some personal professional development of my own that sort of backs up why this interests me that I wanted to share with all of you. Shameless plug moment. This comes very much from the culmination of my new book that I published last summer, which is called Russia Reconsidered, Putin Power and Pragmatism. And it was a subsequent book tour after that publication I conducted in the early fall in Russia that obviously led to a lot of new insights and fascinating conclusions and epiphanies of my own, especially on this topic. Also, there was some unique enlightenment. The university was very generous in supporting me going to Oxford University this past fall in 2018 to attend the Oxford Internet Institute's biannual conference. Ironically, I was presenting a different project there that dealt with virtual counterterrorism programs in America. But as you might expect in a biannual conference, that meant the last time the Oxford Internet Institute held the conference, it was just before the 2016 presidential election in America. So as you might expect, there was an awful lot of research and data and reports being given at the 2018 conference about what took place in 2016. And then finally, I'm currently living here in Omaha, Nebraska, and I've sort of continuously worked in a very positive and productive relationship with the United States Strategic Command, which is headquartered here in Offutt Air Force Base, and also specifically with the Russia desk of the 97th Intelligence Squadron. So that's sort of the background, personally, of why I'm so professionally interested in this topic. Ultimately, when we look at the digital data of trolling, and forgive NBC News when they first put this out, the Internet Research Association is now more commonly known as the Internet Research Agency. It is a very nondescript vanilla building on a very nondescript vanilla street in the middle of St. Petersburg, Russia, that is now considered sort of ground zero for all of Russian trolling, at least as done by the Russian government or aimed from the Russian government toward American society. And this is where these types of data points made us realize that there's something irregular moving in that could not be explained just by saying, oh, there were international parties interested in the 2016 American presidential election. Because as we get closer and closer to the election, you see the intensity of the activity increases to a point where it's almost nonstop and then continues and slightly fades off a little bit as it heads towards 2017. So that was the first little snippet of understanding for us that something odd is going on here and we need to look at it. Also, in addition, when we sort of broke that intensity down, we saw spikes on specific days that eerily, spookily timed with significant political events in the American campaign. So we would see big spikes when Trump was declared the Republican nominee, big spike the day after Hillary Clinton accepted the Democratic nomination, when there was the bombing in Chelsea Piers in New York City, when Trump held a big town hall in New Hampshire, and then Election Day itself. So in addition to sort of the generalization of this intensive increase in activity as far as trolling emanating from Russia, we also saw when you got into the details of it that there were specific spikes coinciding with specific events that also just made it couldn't be coincidental with what we were looking at. I like this slide simply because it shows, if you look at the bottom left corner, what we see is the aggregate local American news in terms of its tweeting activity, internet, virtual, social media activity, dealing with the election campaign and post-election activity. And so it's a solid baseline, steady flow, but relatively small. And it gets you then on the top two, the left troll, right troll. You can see how there was definitive spikes that went way beyond what would be, say, normal aggregate newscast social media activity. The thing to remember, and I find students often don't get this at first, and so I just point it out to audiences in general, is that when you see the left troll and right troll, it's to remember that the right trolls and left trolls, they mimic to almost an absurd, farcical level, quote-unquote, stereotypical left and right positions. So the right trolls would be memes and such that are virulently anti-immigrant left trolls would sort of farcically support, quote-unquote, Black Lives Matter activists. So whenever you see data about left trolls, it's clearly being, when it was done from the Internet Research Agency, it's being done to incite and inspire people who naturally lean to the right. And the right troll memes are done to naturally inspire and instigate people who lean naturally to the left. So it's just a little small detail to focus and emphasize on. I had a colleague, very respected colleague, mentioned they love this slide. He said it reminds them of the masks people wear at Mardi Gras in New Orleans. And now, because of that, thank you very much, Dr. Drumhiller, because now I can't see this slide and see anything except Mardi Gras in New Orleans. But it shows the bigger point of these sort of mapping the data points of activity, left-leaning, right-leaning, in terms of vicious, pernicious, polarizing memes during the election campaign and immediately after, is it was slightly more leaning to the left, but relatively evenly distributed and evenly dispersed. So the idea that it was just simply pro-Trump, 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 we want to get Trump elected, we have to get Trump elected, there's at least some subtlety here that we need to pay more attention to, because it goes beyond such a simplistic interpretation. The Russian troll tweets by day, you could see the specific spikes, and we'll come back to this slide in just a second once we move past. You see the highest spike in terms of the left trolls that would try to inspire the people who naturally lean right took place on October 6th. That's right before the WikiLeaks release of the Clinton campaign email, where that spike almost completely goes off the charts, quite frankly. But there's this interesting, the next significant spike, and all of these marks, it should be noted, are extremely high and far higher than any kind of aggregate American news company. But the biggest spike in terms of right trolls, that high season, as it says for right trolls, was in the summer of 2017, so a full 6 months after Trump got elected. And that will be important, as we'll see, because remember, if it's a high season for right trolls are inspiring and inciting people who naturally are liberal, not naturally conservative. Also, the massive scale, it just goes to show you that it was very pervasive, it was comprehensive, whether we're talking about Facebook ads, Facebook posts, Instagram posts, Twitter posts. There's actually been an increase in activity from the Internet Research Agency in the 6 months after the U.S. election. So these two facts, that spike in the summer of 2017 and the general increase in activity after the election is over, I think leads us into some very important questions about the what and the why. Because traditionally so far here in the States, what we've asked is, well, what was the goal? Well, the goal was to elect Trump. But I'm not sure if this type of data shows us that the goal was purely really to elect Trump, that they were just simply on the side of the Trump campaign team, and that was their only thing. Because one, it should dissipate after the election if that's true. Two, we shouldn't see such an even distribution of trying to incite both sides against one another. The other asked question that tends to get asked quite a bit is, why was the goal? And the most common answer, especially amongst liberal camps in the United States, is that, well, the Russians hate Hillary Rodham Clinton. That was why they did it. Why do they do that? We don't really know. Maybe it's just Russians are innately sexist and they didn't want a female president, but whatever it is, they didn't want Hillary Clinton. And there's sort of an anecdote I wanted to share with people is from that conference at Oxford, at the Oxford Internet Institute, there one team in particular I remember from Texas Christian University. So TCU had a team, a scholarly team over at Oxford, and they were examining the Russian social media agenda. And they established, just like we've seen, some clear favoritism, strong support for Trump over Clinton. But the comment that I found really curious was that the lead scholar in the team from TCU said they were unable to explain why Russia would choose Trump over Clinton. That was weird to me in a simple sense. And so I simply asked the question, do you think there's no evidence that could sort of legitimately explain from a foreign policy, geopolitics perspective, why would Russia prefer Trump over Clinton? And when she was pressed, the lead scholar simply claimed she didn't want to presume she could read Putin's mind, and that was the end of the discussion. And I always found that very curious, because no one was asking anyone to read President Putin's mind. It was just follow the evidence and let the evidence speak in your project. So it was the first example I received, so this was about 6 months ago, that even in our own objective, highly analytical, rigorous scholarship, some of our own scholars are sort of self-disinforming, if I can use it, make up a term on the fly. There was sort of self-disinformation. They didn't want to put in the project any legitimate foreign policy justification that might explain a preference for Trump over Clinton, because perhaps understandably here in the United States, there are still, especially in the academic community, there are a lot of people still very upset over the results of the election of Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. So do we have the what and the why correct? Is it truly the goal was simply to elect Trump, or is there something even more pernicious and something more important to the goal? And as far as the why is the goal, can we look deeper into the, well, they just don't like Hillary Clinton? So when we do that, we start to figure out why the Russians don't like Hillary. She's the one who came out and said, in reference, of course, to Vladimir Putin, tough guy with a thin skin. Putin is playing the long game. He has a strategic plan in mind, the Eurasian reunion. And I put these up not to criticize Hillary Clinton, but to actually try and emphasize how are these received, these types of comments, how are they received from Russian foreign policy geopolitical perspective? Hillary is an expert at making comments that to an American audience sounds very vanilla. They sound very vanilla, they sound very, very, very banal, very impossible to get mad at them, but they incite Russians like you wouldn't believe. This quote, which seems very blah at first glance, is sort of received on the Russian side as like, how dare Putin think he has a right to compete with us and our allied organization? Whereas Putin was saying, you don't ever actually let us truly be part of the European Union, so we have a right to compete then with the European Union. We'll create our own union. We'll have the Eurasian Union. It's our right to do that. You simply deny us the right to do that. He doesn't have a soul. I'm not going to berate this point, but rightly or wrongly, accurately or inaccurately, Russians often pride themselves on being devout Orthodox Christians. So taking a shot at Putin on this sort of semi-spiritual level definitely grinds the gears of a Russian a little bit more than maybe an American would think is a big deal. I love this quote from Tim Kaine, who was Hillary Clinton's, if we remember, running mate in 2016. Vladimir Putin is a dictator. He's not a leader. Anybody who thinks otherwise doesn't know Russian history. They don't know Vladimir Putin. I would debate that. But anyway, the more important point for me is if people remember a little bit in their recent Russian history, that weird 2008 to 2012 period where Putin had to technically step down from being president because the Russian Constitution didn't allow you to be president for three consecutive terms, he basically did the switcheroo with his prime minister so that Medvedev became president for 4 years and Putin was officially prime minister, quote unquote. The Russians have always seen Russian prime minister position relatively low, and they've always also seen that whatever opinion comes from the prime minister, when it wasn't Putin in those 4 years, of course, is really just the opinion of the president. That's the role of the prime minister, is to parrot whatever the president thinks. They feel the same way about vice president. So this may come from Tim Kaine, but no Russian would read this and see Tim Kaine. They would see Hillary Clinton. They would say, this is not Tim Kaine's opinion. This is Hillary Clinton's opinion calling out Vladimir Putin through a secondary. When she was the head of state, so when she was the Secretary of State, she was in charge of the State Department and it enacted the Magnitsky Act, which was basically, I love this, I wrote about this at the time. You know, to me, it was a very strange and interesting individualized version of international sanctions, where they basically just targeted Putin friends for the sanctions. And I could only imagine, like, in that tight, close Putin circle, they must have been like, whatever the Russian version is of, oh, you're making it personal. You're making it personal, snap, snap, snap. We're going to do something about that. And here's another one of those vanilla banal kind of quotes. I'd be delighted if the United States could have a positive relationship with Russia, and I'd be thrilled if the Russian people, who are so capable, had a normal country that they could chart a different future. Besides the somewhat condescending attitude or tone that it comes off when you talk about them being so capable, the thing that Russians read when they read that quote, which I think most Americans don't see, is that they interpret that literally as code from Hillary Clinton, as basically stating, I hope the Russian people figure it out and overthrow this creep. So it was almost like a public open invitation for the Russian people to create a revolution against the president. That's how it's interpreted from the Russian side. She compared the secession of Crimea over to the Russian Federation as akin to the maneuvers made by Hitler in the early 1930s. This is, for people who know this area and know their history, unlike Tim Kaine, if you're going to go Nazi, make sure you're really sure about what your goal is and what you want to do if you're ever going to go Nazi with Russians. There's a reason the Russians don't call it World War II, but call it the Great Patriotic Fatherland War. They are convinced that the only reason the quote-unquote West won World War II is because they first sacrificed so much on the Eastern Front in fighting Hitler and lost so many millions of people. I don't need to debate that, but I'm saying, again, the perspective of the Russians is that they won the war. The war was more about their homeland than anybody else's. And so when you go Nazi in comparing any contemporary Russian initiatives and affairs, it really bites to a deeper degree than maybe most American audiences would be aware of. She was also openly vocal for international sanctions aimed at crippling Russia domestically in the aftermath of the Crimean referendum. I like to tell this story because it's one of the things that Americans usually poo-poo on sanctions quite a bit and say they're never tough enough, they're never strict enough, they don't have a big enough opinion. To this day, since those initial sanctions, for almost an entire generation, if you go back to when the Soviet Union dissolved, almost immediately the course for rubles to dollars has been a very stable 31-1. So it's for basically my entire adult life, it was 31 rubles to $1, and it is, you know, fluctuates here and there a little bit based on global economic problems. 2008 housing crisis comes to mind, but for the most part, it has hovered right there at that level with great stability and great reliability. Within 1 year after the international sanctions, after the Crimean referendum, the course doubled from 31 to 62, and last time I checked just the other day, it was 65. And people don't realize that actually truly affecting the everyday lives of people, because going from 31 to 62 just basically halves the earning and purchasing the consumer power of everyday Russians. And it has had an effect. It's one of the things that was the most definitive for me during the book tour in Russia was how many people, more than I can ever remember in the last generation, just wanting to leave Russia, not because they hate Russia or they think Russia's a bad guy, but they find it too difficult and they find it not as many options. There aren't as many optimal opportunities for them moving into the future, and so they think they need to just leave and pursue opportunities elsewhere. That's a definitive change in sort of Russian popular attitude based on the sanctions that I think most Americans think didn't do do anything or didn't have a major impact. But it definitely left an impression on Russians that you're actually now not just, first you try to aim at my friends, this is Putin talking, you aim specifically at my close friends, trying to avoid hurting Russian people. But then you've moved forward and you've hurt Russian people. Regardless of just or unjust, the Russian perspective is this is interference, direct and explicit. This is why this type of complaining from Hillary after the election falls on deaf ears in Russia. They're like, basically, yeah, prove it. Show me that we made people literally change their votes by what we've done. And besides, you were messing with us long before we ever did anything like that. So that leads to that ultimate question from the Russian side, who is messing with whom? She was vocal about her concerns over the 2012 Russian presidential election, claiming all these attempts. The attempts, supposed attempts, are not necessarily proof, but attempts to stuff ballot box, manipulate voter lists, other troubling practices, which led in 2013 to Putin to have Putin give this quote. Our partners shake us from time to time so that we don't forget who owns this planet, so that we know they have methods of pressure and influence on our country from within. I love that quote. One, not just because it was fully 3 years before 2016, but it's very much in line with how Russians prefer to be in terms of their foreign policy. They prefer in your face. They prefer making it known. The bravado and the machismo that seems to be innate to Russian foreign policy is on full display here. So it almost makes it confusing to Russians in the aftermath of 2016 when they're like, I don't know why, when American scholars say, I don't know why they prefer Trump over Hillary, I don't understand. And they're like, I just told you. Like, I can see Putin literally be like, what do you mean you don't understand where this is coming from? I just told you in 2013, you tried to mess with us. Turnabout will be fair play, so you should be prepared. And it's fine. You messed with us. We didn't complain out loud about it, but we will have our just desserts in the end. So that's the investigation sort of in a nutshell, and we can talk forever on each version, to be honest, about the what and the why. But that's only the front end of the process. The back end interests me more, and the back end of this process is actually the how. How did the effort actually have an effect on the American people in 2016 and in the aftermath? So far, for the most part, most, and as proven in the Oxford Internet Institute, most of our analysis has been fascinated with the technological how. Like, how did they do it? How can we prove it? Attribution concepts and concerns. How do we know what they're doing and trying to do again? But no one seems to be asking the how question that actually is on the societal level. How it impacts the American people and why would it impact it? To get to that, it seemed to me that we need to understand this thing that we now call post-truth. And post-truth officially, after the sort of one-two gut punch to the Oxford dictionaries in 2016, the first being Brexit. People almost now have already forgotten that the original decision about Brexit took place just before the American 2016 presidential election, and then the presidential election of Donald Trump. The Oxford dictionaries coined the term, well, they didn't really coin it, but they chose the term post-truth as its word of the year in 2016. And so the official Oxford definition of post-truth is there, relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion, appeals to emotion and personal belief. If you really want to know where it actually was coined, we actually have to go back to 1992 by a Serbian-American playwright named Tesic, who was trying to figure out the true long-term consequences on an American generation, my generation, Generation X, who was born and emerging and evolving from the trauma of the Nixon Watergate scandal. Now, you're fully within your rights to ask, why was a Serbian-American playwright in the early 90s trying to figure out the true long-term consequences on Americans from the trauma of Nixon Watergate? I have no idea. I tried my best to figure that out. It seems to be lost in the annals of history. But whatever reason was motivating Tesic, he was the one who came with the term, because he said that American citizens didn't want bad news anymore, that as a free people, they freely decided that they want to live in some post-truth world. That's where the term was coined and where it came from. And he further explained that since the pursuit of truth seemed to always be bitter disappointment and bad news, then maybe it would just be better if people would lie to us. But it always came, but that lying came with a caveat, that the lying had to be done in my interest, personally. That lie if you want, but make sure it syncs up and aligns with my worldview. And I love this because this is 1992, not fully in the technological age as we know it today. This is just Generation X kvetching, if you will, about their problems and the world that they live in. If anything, I think the millennial generation that we're now teaching might have it worse in terms of what we were complaining about in the early 90s. Those problems are only more intensified today, are only more pervasive and more comprehensive. Going further for post-truth, it was confirmed on a much more scientific level when a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, of all people, tied the concept of cognitive ease to post-truth, because they found in terms of neuroscience and brain chemistry, humans often have a tendency, or at least seem to have a tendency, to avoid facts that would be challenging to their brains and force them to think in ways that are uncomfortable compared to their previously held facts. What I found interesting is that, in reality, that concept of cognitive ease, Americans had already spent a decade fully engaging, even if they had never heard the psychological term cognitive ease before. And that is, if you remember Stephen Colbert, who's the famous, now took over for David Letterman for The Late Show on CBS, and he was a comedian from The Daily Show before that and very popular. He coined the term in 2006, truthiness. His reason for using it was because, if you remember, in 2006, we were in full bore, the global war on terror, and we were trying to figure out how do we come to terms with an America that supposedly believes in rule of law, transparency, justice, and yet at the same time we have black site prisons around the world for extraordinary rendition instead of due process, for torture, but we call it forced interrogation. So what Colbert did is basically say, it's, we want the truth, but we want it sort of desensitized, destigmatized. We want truthiness more than we want truth. And it became so popular and so funny to most people that it was Merriam-Webster's term this time to have truthiness be the word of the year in 2006. And to me, truthiness is literally nothing except cognitive ease. They just didn't know they were dealing in deep psychology. And then finally, to sort of encapsulate this negative zeitgeist that we currently live in, I think this all of this was perfectly captured by the infamous, famous in Russia, infamous in the West, Kremlin propagandist slash quasi-journalist Dmitry Kisilov. Kisilov was the one who declared that the age of neutral journalism, the age of neutral information, is dead and is past. And he said, what most Americans in particular, but Westerners in general, you don't understand that you think having all this access to information online, all this infinite, limitless information, makes you smarter, makes you more intelligent, makes you more engaged and aware. But the problem you don't understand is this huge sea of information that you're selecting from is already coming to you subjective to begin with. So you can't become objective when you're already only pursuing and selecting information that's horribly subjective to begin. Not saying we should take Kisilov as the authority figure of all things, given his notorious reputation, but I do find that comment worthy of debate, worthy of discussion, because it's quite interesting in terms of what type of internet, what type of technological world do we live in today, and how does it affect our thinking and the way we acquire information. So what does post-truth disinformation? If this is the combination that I'm pushing for now, that so far for the most part we haven't really considered as much, what does post-truth and disinformation look like really? I just selected from left and right random selections. Thank you for all my conservative and staunchly conservative and liberal friends who openly post this all the time on their own feed. And I just sort of randomly selected things that show you. So we have Putin as chairman of the Republican Party. This is a fantastic, if you have any kind of Sovietologists in the audience who love the old school, like, propaganda posters, this is a perfect copy of what used to be, like, Stalinist propaganda posters with, of course, the Hillary profile, exactly where the Stalin profile would have been, but welcoming you to the Democrat Party, where the Democrat Party is now the party of violence and racism and fascism. So it's this, these memes are always about flipping upside down the stereotypical positions most people presume. The famous meme that's been used for many different purposes from the movie Goodfellas, and then this one is on the left, talking about how all these anti-Obama Republican people are now telling me that we have to stop being so divisive, we have to be patriotic, we have to respect the President of the United States, when they never did during the 8 years of Obama. On the right, sorry for the longness of this, but the other part that these memes tend to do is they mask conspiracy theory in a way that they try to make it sound still intellectual and therefore partially legitimate. So I bet people in the audience didn't realize that ultimately Obama was a Trojan horse meant to normalize Marxist values and weaken the U.S., and that plan also then called for nuclear war with North Korea, followed, of course, by a communist New World Order led by Hillary Clinton, of course, as president. So literally you need to understand that Trump saved the world from all of this. I also love when they do the reverses. The memes tend to reverse. One of the most common conservative positions in memes has always been, if you don't like America, then leave. How many people have heard that? The sort of the very stereotypical patriotic dissent. If you don't like the way we do things, then go live in another country to see how you fare. Well, this is a left-leaning meme that does turn the flipperoo on them and say, well, if you want a government based on a religious book, move to Iran. Otherwise, read your constitution and shut the hell up. I love this one for student audiences because most students of the millennial generation have never heard of Audie Murphy and so don't know his personal story. And the bottom part of it, as you can read, is comparing what Audie Murphy did at the top to what most millennials are today in the most egregious sort of radicalized, politicized version. PTSD from offensive words, requiring safe spaces, coddled. So it's a direct attack on young people and sort of a generational warfare. Another on the left, you chant lock her up while literally committing treason. One of the other things I lament in terms of disinformation, post-truth disinformation, is irony is dead. I really appreciate irony. I wish irony would come back, but for the most part, no one seems to appreciate irony anymore. And this one I also have a soft spot for because I love how this person, whoever this person was that made the meme, I wish sometimes I could always preface all my conferences and all my speeches and all my presentations with like, listen, this is going to be some of my greatest work. You guys really need to pay attention. I'm so much smarter than all of you anyway, so just please let this sink in because I'm clearly too deep for all of you. So I love a meme where the meme maker has to sort of preface and sort of explain how great they are. I'm a huge fan of Willy Wonka, so I had to get one of those in here. And it's in this sort of the left criticism about how everyone has to protect liberty, can't tread on liberty, but then there are other areas, obviously, where they freely are willing to tread on liberty. And this one, excuse the French phrase at the bottom, but what I love about this is it shows the other example of what they do is there's sort of a twisting of history, a blatant twisting of history, and again, the absence of irony. Because the top part of this meme is correct, this right-leaning meme. Our forefathers did not politely protest. They did not vote anyone out of office. They didn't impeach a king or march on the Capitol. But they didn't do that because they couldn't, because they didn't exist in a democracy. They were a colony under a monarchy. And they fought, and the reason they fought, one could argue, is that they fought exactly for the rights that are being criticized at the top. So it's that the right is trying to talk about patriotism without knowing that they're creating memes that are actually undermining the very concept of patriotism as created by the forefathers. That happens a lot in these memes, this kind of absent irony, poor history, twisted fundamentals and principles. This one always gets a laugh from student audiences because most student audiences tend to lean liberal. So what science? I don't know. Some were Republicans. And then this last one I want to cover, I find it interesting, not trying to create too big of a role for myself in this debate, but about a year and a half ago, and I wrote an article about these two memes together, I found these two memes literally 4 days apart. So they took the exact, and since then I have not found a meme that does this. So it was almost as if they like understood, ooh, this was ineffective, whoever was doing it, we can't do it this way. So they used the vandalizing of the Trump star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame and used it first to criticize the left, because Kevin Spacey's and Bill Cosby's stars were left untouched. So that must mean people who are liberal are obviously morally at peace with sexual deviants and rapists and pedophiles and everything else. Whereas on the right-hand side, this was the left launching back and saying, okay, we destroyed that one, so we have one Horcrux if there are any Harry Potter fans in the audience. One Horcrux down, six to go. And it's a perfect example of where you twist reality, because the fact of the matter is Kevin Spacey and Bill Cosby have in fact been completely isolated and ostracized from their communities, and their careers are over. Bill Cosby's in jail. Kevin Spacey might end up there soon enough. And so there isn't any morally at peace with those actions, but that's what's getting pushed in the meme. And despite what anyone may think, I'm fairly certain that Donald Trump is actually not Voldemort. So it's the exaggeration, the hyperbole meant to irritate and make people angry. So where do we go from here? What is society's end game when it comes to post-truth? Are we citizens that are unknowing dupes in the process, or are we starting to become the willful participants pushing the phenomenon forward? And what matters to me a lot is that last sentence at the bottom is, there seems to be a mistake, and it isn't generational. It's not an age thing, it seems to me, that affirming what I believe is not, in fact, the same as confirming what I think. And I come across more and more people who either do think it's the same thing, or they actually think the former, affirming what you believe, is more important than confirming what you think. And there's this sort of critical segue we have to do. Is this the true state of America in 2019, where the outrage culture creates simple but wrong answers and everybody wants to go in that direction, whereas the critical thinkers, where it's complex and difficult to figure out, but it's the right path to do, you will only see a handful of people. And this leads me to my second anecdote. Again, through the generous support of my university, I was able to just attend the International Studies Association conference in Toronto. One of the panels I presented on was called Intelligence and Post-Truth. And there was a very lovely person, a Georgetown graduate student, on that panel. And we got into a heated debate with the audience about what do we do about this, that yes, this is the problem, but how do we fix the problem? And they started waxing poetic, I swear, on things. As someone who got his start with teaching a lot of political theory, ancient political theory and classical political theory, I was excited to hear someone start talking about Aristotelian ethics and sophistry and pathos and dramatis personae. But the problem with it was that they were ultimately simply saying the elite thinkers, the true elites, have to deliver the people from their ignorance and from their stupidity. And what I worry about is that attitude seems to be part of the problem that got us into this situation to begin with. And so I've often been left at the moment with thinking that our solution is a quote-unquote hard easy. Analytical thinking, critical reasoning, discernment, vetting sources, the joy of learning new information, not being afraid to be wrong, these used to be, I'd like to think they still are, but for sure they used to be the core principles of American higher education. They were the foundation of what Aristotle started when he did the academy back in ancient Greece. But more often than not, it seems now that it almost seems they've become buzzwords that are not only not taken seriously by many people, they're almost derided by people instead. So it's not to be ignored, it's meant to be dismissed. Intelligence equals elitism, which equals deserving of derision. Self-educated is where it's at. But what are the standards? These are the questions I ask myself. Like, what's the evaluation? What's your proof of progress? Access does not automatically mean acquisition. And unfortunately, it seems we're now in America living in a society where that's exactly what it does mean. Simply having access means acquisition. How do we reverse sort of this insipid trend of our modernity? And the perfect, this came through, this happened to me just last week. It was a perfect example in my own life of the problem we're dealing with. I was engaged in a social media internet debate and on a think tank that was discussing the Electoral College. And so you had obviously very strong sides going for and against. And it basically was partisan. The people who were for the Electoral College were at the moment now Republican, by and by. The people who are thinking maybe the Electoral College is outdated and an antiquity and doesn't need to be in existence were now largely liberal and on the Democrat side. But there was one person who was ranting about needing to keep the Electoral College and it keeps the rural people relevant and keeps the smaller population areas still significant. And I actually wrote, I admit freely, a fairly long post in this sort of virtual debate supporting that position of why the Electoral College might still be valuable, why we shouldn't necessarily just dismiss it. And the person wrote back in the debate box that, I'm sorry, I really couldn't read. I didn't read your whole, I'm going to freely admit, I didn't read your whole post. I only read the first sentence because it was just too long. But the post supported her position. It supported her position more in an evidence-based fashion rather than the emotional, self-righteous indignation that was happening. And someone else chimed in to protect her because I simply wrote back to that one. I admit I was being a bit catty. I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't know what you were trying to tell me because I only read the first sentence of your post because you only read the first sentence of mine. Not my greatest scholarly moment in life, but still, it felt good in the moment. Someone chimed in on that, taking issue with how I reacted, and said, why are you being such an ass? And that other person, the original person I had tried to support, said, oh, he teaches. He teaches. We are doers. Just two totally different approaches in life. And they thought that was the end of the debate. But at this point, I had already basically shoved any kind of academic etiquette out the window on my part, I think. So I just said, so should I say then that you two doers never bothered to truly educate yourselves, therefore you think only on a superficial plane, you therefore have no real substantive comments to make, and therefore I should just ignore you, because, you know, doers, you've just said doers aren't teachers, so therefore doers aren't thinkers, therefore doers just must be dummers. Again, not my greatest academic moment in life, but the response came literally with just two words, obnoxious much? And I was like, it was you people who called me an ass to begin with, over a comment that was trying to support your arguments, but to support it in a way that was more rigorous and scientific and academic and intellectual. You couldn't be bothered with that. And then on top of it, you simply judged my entire life without knowing who I was or what I have done, because you found out my profession was actually connected to education. And as we all know, education is like the haven and the den of Satanists. And so you think I'm obnoxious. And so how do we switch? Ultimately, what all of this leads me to is, how do we switch this final meme? Because what I worry about most in all of this, in terms of disinformation wars, is that the Russians didn't really just manipulate people. I fear they inspired people, right? Because it was all the memes I showed you, left and right, that series of 10, none of those came from the Internet Research Agency. They came from Americans. So when I see, in closing, I see Mark Zuckerberg, you know, founder and head honcho of Facebook, come forward and say, governments need to help us. We can't regulate all the problems we're finding on social media in terms of hatred and incitement and polarization and disinformation. Governments need to help us, quote-unquote, regulate. No, it's not censorship, but regulate. And I do a lot of work, actually, with both the Finnish and the Estonian National Defense Academies, who are extremely proactive and very aggressive in terms of understanding aspects of cyber defense and cyber deterrence. They're clamoring right now and thinking it might be a good idea to create a cyber NATO. So when you take the anecdote of what I just related on the debate about the Electoral College, or that Georgetown graduate student who wanted elite deliverance, or Zuckerberg wanting governments to help out, or the Finns and the Estonians talking about a cyber NATO, I can't help but sometimes worry and wonder if this is all just really insulting to us as human beings. Because it seems to me that the ultimate defense against disinformation is to go back to those original founding core principles of higher education that we used to value so much and used to think these are the key skill sets we're trying to give students, not just simply a major and a degree. And self-educated or done through an institution, that doesn't really matter. If you have a people truly dedicated to the ideals of analytical thinking, critical reasoning, learning new information, not being afraid of being wrong, it seems to me that most of the stuff that the Russians did in 2016 and may be trying to do in 2020 would be easily defeated. That the ability to simply check whether a meme is actually right, to sort of fight your own desire for cognitive ease, is how disinformation gets defeated. We do not need cyber NATOs. We do not need elite deliverance. And we most certainly do not need governments getting in the way to try to tell us what we should be reading or not reading. So it's confusing for me to try and figure out why, on a scholarship level, so many of us are almost dismissing the people who could provide our true deliverance. So, that's the end of that presentation. Thankfully, we do have some time left if there are questions.
Wonderful. Thank you for that, Matt. It looks like we've got a question from Adrienne in the chat, more reflective. How do we know that is the truth?
If I had a perfect answer for that, I would bottle it, copyright it, and sell it, and my retirement would be answered. I think, though, honestly, while I love the question, I think we can, and I'm not trying to sidestep it or avoid it, I don't think answering that question necessarily, because it's extremely difficult, I don't think that necessarily provides the deliverance we need, in the sense that I need people who want to figure out where the untruth is. Because what seems to be in the aftermath of 2016 and rampant disinformation and inspiring other groups, American groups, to do disinformation of their own, you don't need to know what the truth is as much as being able to discern where false information is being presented to you. The example I like to give student groups a lot is if people remember the Killery List. So there was this idea, and it was obviously founded from the right, was the idea that literally, I think at last count, it was something like 48 people who were on the verge, literally on the verge of going to Capitol Hill and testify against Hillary Clinton for all of her corruption and all of her depravity, suddenly either killed themselves, died suspiciously, or met an untimely end in an accident. So the implication was that Hillary had clearly gotten them off because she didn't want them testifying against her on Capitol Hill. Now, I don't know what the truth is as far as how all these people die. I'm actually fairly certain, with a little bit of extra information, a little bit of extra research, you'll discover that Hillary Clinton actually didn't kill 48 people. So in that way, there still may be questions about what certain things are, but you can still get to where you can find out what disinformation is and where it's disinformation and how it's disinformation. So I might never be able to answer, none of us might be able to answer what is truth, but you can certainly answer what is fake.
I think that's a great point, Matt. You draw attention to a number of things, and I always thought that was pretty funny, all of the people pointing to how Hillary Clinton had whacked 48 people. So it's one of those charming things that is burst in the internet.
it's always blown my mind because the people who would do the Killery List really did, honest to God, if you ever spoke to one, they believed themselves to be patriots. Right, that they're doing this because of their patriotism, but that patriotism is also painting a picture of a country that was saying someone could be a leading candidate for president of the United States while also simultaneously being responsible for the deaths of 48 people, and no charges are brought, no investigations are brought forward. So it's literally saying, as much as it's a criticism about Hillary Clinton, it's a criticism of the United States in terms of democracy and rule of law. And they never see that. They never see as let that be a spur to you to do more research into what you're actually saying.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like I see Jeff and a couple others are typing in the chat, so we're looking for a couple more questions to come in, I think.
I'll just talk, if you don't mind. I'll talk while we wait for them to come in.
You're welcome to keep talking, Matt.
I don't like pregnant pauses. What bothers me maybe the most when people say, "Well, what you're a Russian guy, blah blah blah. You've loved researching Russia for a long, long time." It makes me perplexed that is it possible that in terms of what they did in 2016, did they analyze American society? And it does deeply bother me the idea that they figured out some core flaw in our own society amongst our own citizens to a much deeper degree than we ourselves, our own scholars in American politics, ever figured out. I find that fascinating, even if disturbing.
All right. It looks like what kind of changes will we see in the U.S.-Russia relations after the recent report?
The Mueller report, yeah.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, and this is sort of, for me at least, because I've written and published on this, over 2 years ago, I did say there will not be collusion will not be found. There will not be a verdict of collusion. But it wasn't a supportive statement of Donald Trump. The reason, and this is because of my background with Russia, the reason I felt collusion wouldn't be found is because people are looking at it strictly from what's Trump's motivation? What was the campaign team's motivation for Trump in seeking information or trying to establish contact with the Russians? What seems to be missing in all of this is an analysis about what was the motivation of the Russians and how do they actually tend, depending on the asset, how do they try to establish connection. Collusion implies, to be totally honest, and it's one of the things that I think doesn't get discussed, collusion implies mutually beneficial partnership. Collusion is not blackmail. And we've sort of forgotten about this because they've described Trump in a position as being compromised by the Russians and therefore he's going to collude. If Russians have compromised the information on you, they're not going to collude. They're going to manipulate you. They will simply exploit you. There's no need to collude because they have what they want and they can do it as they wish. So I never thought there'd be collusion, because I don't think the Russians only collude with people that they think they can actually rely upon and they actually wish to have a mutually beneficial relationship with. And the Russians have known and have had information on Trump since the late 80s, because Trump has had quasi-business with Russia since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and even slightly before during the Gorbachev era with Perestroika and Glasnost. So I think they've known who Donald Trump was for a very, very long time as a human being, and I don't think they ever would see Donald Trump as a figure who would be reliable in terms of a collusion response. So having said that, with the original question, I don't see anything changing in the near future, because Donald Trump cannot do anything. Like, nothing Donald Trump can do towards Russia will be accepted or allowed, especially after the midterm elections of 2018. He just can't. He's painted himself willingly or unwillingly, accidentally or purposely, he's in a corner when it comes to Russian affairs, and nothing can be done. But conversely, saying that, Democrats are almost in a way in the same painted corner, because they now feel like anyone making any gesture toward Russian affairs or toward Russian leadership would be seen as suspicious, or why would you do that? Look what they did to us. So we're sort of stuck at the moment in a very damaging cycle of mistrust, suspicion, and rhetoric that won't end, whether it's Democrat or Republican. So for the immediate future, that's not going to change. I'm trying to rewrite.
What is it? Yeah, but it looks like we have one in the chat that asks if the efforts that you discussed here are a continuity from the Soviet kind of operations in the past.
I think if you look at the Russian side, and that's one of the things, there's a temptation always to see the Soviets / Russians historically or contemporarily as like some sort of James Bond villain. They knew exactly what they were doing. Everyone in America had no idea Trump was going to win, but the Russians knew. And I think the Russians were as shocked and as absolutely flabbergasted over the results of 2016 as anyone else. I truly do believe that. So their sophistication of their efforts, if you really look at what they did, not very sophisticated. But that means there's where the continuity ends, because in Soviet times, it was just the world was different, technological access was different, and therefore people in the United States were different. This is why the examination of post-truth, I think, is so crucial in understanding the effectiveness of disinformation. There wasn't a post-truth society in, say, 1955 and 1965 in the height of the Cold War, but there is one today, without doubt. And part of the reason there is one is because of how we gain access to technology and how we process information and what we want to do with it. That's very good. It has nothing to do with how the Russians enacted disinformation, Russian active measures, as they would have as, say, Soviet active measures. It was the audience that has changed rather than the perpetrator. And that, I think, is getting lost in the debate quite a bit, because they want to just put the true blame on the people who did it and absolve the people who received it of any responsibility or culpability. And I think there is some culpability there to be discussed. I'm reading Jeff's
And I see Jeff with a question in the chat is looking for your insight on the role of American intelligence in this conversation, and whether or not it should be the role of American intelligence to tell people where deception is coming in within these different campaigns.
I think it's a fantastic and a truly, truly important question, and I think it's a very delicate answer because of what we had is when I mentioned how the social media debate on the Electoral College or how the overall reaction was to the Georgetown graduate student at the ISA, it seems to me, I might be wrong, but we currently live in a society in America where if it smacks to many people as being highly intellectualized or elitist or, oh, you're going to tell me what to think and what to believe, they automatically reject it, even if you're not trying to do that. And how we defeat that cynicism is, I think, truly, truly important, but I'm not necessarily sure how you do that, because I can definitely see if American scholars, American professors, are being sort of outright dismissed by so many people in America today because of the affiliation of intellectual means elite, which means deserving of derision. I don't think the American intelligence community is necessarily going to succeed more easily in convincing people they have the best interests of the people at heart. So it's a very important thing, but that's why I'm trying to actually avoid the idea of elite deliverance? Because in a way, that same question could easily smack to some people as it's just elite deliverance of a different kind. It's either academic elite deliverance or intelligence elite deliverance or politicians elite deliverance. It all just gets rejected automatically. So if on a grassroots level, that's where I'm sort of more fascinated, is how do we create a grassroots initiative that makes people motivated to go back to those core academic principles we used to hold so dear?
Matt, we've got another question in the chat. Would you agree that the results of information or misinformation to either the Russian or U.S. populations differ only in that the Russian people have one shaped message that they are forced to accept in contrast to U.S. citizens who choose their own disinformation?
Okay, I'll take that one. Let me read that real quick, and then we'll come up because we missed David's just before John's, but I'll go to that after. So, David, I will get to yours in 1 second. I think no. I think I respectfully disagree with that from what John was saying. It's a really important question. And again, it's a level of subtlety in the terms of how much analysis do we get to go inside of what the biggest issue in Russia today, what I find, is a complete lack of standardization, a complete lack of understanding the rules, which definitely disserves the people. It's not that there isn't criticism inside of the Russian Federation. I could take you to Russia and show you programs on television that openly criticize the government. I can show you comedy shows that literally lampoon and lambaste the president and other major figures, political figures in Russia, and nothing happens to them. Nothing happens to them. But then we can have a very minor, insignificant quasi-rock band called Pussy Riot do something that, for whatever reason, just totally irks the hell out of Vladimir Putin, and they end up in jail. And then they come out, they finally get released from jail, and they actually make some statements formally that, if you ask me, are actually worse than the original lyrics of the song that got them in trouble in the first place, and nothing happens to them then. So the arbitrariness, it isn't so much that they only get one shaped message that they're forced to accept, but in the sense that they almost live in an information chaos where they can't figure out what am I supposed to do, where am I supposed to go in terms of this. I don't know, if I do this, I get punished. If I do that, I won't. And in Russia, it doesn't work that way. In certain instances, you do this, you will get punished. Someone else does that same thing, they don't get punished. Someone over here does that, they do. Someone else does that same thing somewhere else, they don't. That almost is scarier to me in a certain way because the unpredictability. But it isn't the same thing as it's sort of a misinterpretation of Russian society to think they're sort of just like bland automatons and do exactly what the government says. There's a deeper richness inside of Russian society than that we don't get to see very often. Now up to David's question, if I can read real quick. And guess, yeah. No, I mean, I see some similarity to this with, I'm wondering if everything always ends up being that the extremes of our spectrums, wherever they happen to be in any given society, English, Russian, American, Chinese, that the extremes at the moment, because of perhaps our technology access, that they seem to carry the day in terms of public discussion and public debate, even if it's a very low quality debate or not a debate at all. And the vast majority of people turned off by those extremes simply disengage. And maybe that's the real problem here, is that maybe Brexit doesn't happen or Trump doesn't happen, or maybe it does. I don't know where you stand politically, but maybe these things don't happen if a vast majority of the population that tends to occupy the moderate middle were more active and more activated, more inspired to participate. I mean, there definitely is a problem in terms of our participation levels in our political debates, that you can have 5,000 people in a country of 100 million, and the 5,000 people carry the day because they're the ones actually carrying the day, and the 99.9 million just aren't part of it, and they're excusing themselves from it. That type of stuff is now coming to a head where I think it has a lot of problems, certainly in American society, as it seems to me.
It looks like we've got another question, Matt, from Sterling. How is the 2016 election Russian meddling really any different than the disinformation campaigns over the last 200 years?
Yeah, I do. Again, I'm not, I as a sort of piggybacks a little bit on the previous question, from Joseph was that I don't see a dramatic difference in terms of what's the aim, what would be the goal of a disinformation campaign, why are we engaging in a disinformation campaign. It's still strategic interest, it's still a lot of classical realism at play here, which I'm, in a weird, twisted way, happy to see, so it's not a complete rereading of everything we've ever been taught and tried to teach, but it's the receiving of the information and the methods in which the information can be delivered. That's radically different even with just 20 years ago. If we go back 20 years, we're talking about 1999. How we received information, how we got access to information, how many different venues in which to take information from was dramatically different in 1999 as opposed to 2019. That part is, again, because the emphasis, and I understand why from a sort of criminal justice perspective, because the emphasis is so heavily on the people doing it, why are they doing it, how do we stop them, it makes us ignore maybe the back-end version is a better concentration. Is you don't have to worry about what people try to do with you with disinformation if you had greater faith in your people to be able to discern disinformation from information. And it seems that that's easy. It seems that that's the hard easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier than trying to stop Russians or any other state, for that matter, interacting with our internet freedom. Like, that's going to continue to happen. And I don't necessarily know if I want to compromise internet freedom or access to information freedom in order, like Mark Zuckerberg saying, governments need to help regulate. I'm not sure that's the answer, or it's just creating a new, deeper, more disturbing problem.
Well, Matt, thank you for the great discussion and all of the questions in the chat. I see that there's one more from Lisa about whether you think Paul Whelan was a U.S. spy.
No.
So asked and answered, Lisa. But thank you all for attending today's presentation.
Thank you, everyone.
We did record the session, so that will be out and on our website, and I will forward you the next event that will be occurring towards the end of May. We're working to get that scheduled. And again, thank you all for attending. Awesome. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you, everyone. Take care.